Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Thank you for joining Training and Tactics Talk on RadioFirehouse.com. I'm Douglas Klein, your host of Training and Tactics Talk, where we focus on real training and real tactics for the firefighters on the street. And our goal is to provide the best training that we possibly can through our podcast, looking at innovative new ideas and, cutting-edge technology that's out there to provide our firefighters and our fire officers with the best ability to train people. And our ultimate goal is to make sure that everyone goes home. And, of course, anytime that you have a question or a comment that you'd like to get to us, send it to podcast@firehouse.com. We'll be glad to address that with you and get it on the air. Today we're going to tackle part of the strategy and tactics that we talked about last week, or last month rather, on the podcast, with taking a look from the textbook now, really going and diving deep into the heart of strategy and tactics. Today we're going to hit size up and talk about situational awareness of truly what's going on the scene. What I've done is I've invited a guest on today to join us. It's Christopher Nahm. Chris has been in the fire service an enormous amount of time, probably 30-plus years, if I'm not mistaken. Chris has been very active in fire suppression roles. He currently works in a nuclear power plant facility. He's been a regular contributor to Firehouse.com. He's the second vice president for the International Society of Fire Service Instructors and really specializes a whole lot in the focus of some company officer development and especially building construction and the tactics and philosophies that go with that with the fire service. So, Chris, welcome aboard. It's good to have you on the show and look forward to discussing some of the things that we've talked about recently at a conference and how situational awareness truly does apply to size up.
Well, thanks, Doug. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be on the show here today and talk a little bit further about some of the issues dealing with size up and situational awareness and looking more importantly at the built environment that really plays a major role in what we do every single day in the streets and how it plays out with line of duty deaths, reduction issues, and firefighter safety.
Well, Chris, here recently, and it was just this past weekend, I was at the North Carolina Fire Chiefs Association and sat in a class called Saving Our Own. But one of the things, it was not the typical saving your own class that you would think about with rapid intervention. It was really taking a situational awareness look at how we compare ourselves to the Powell Doctrine and wartime or, military tactics. And I found that to be very interesting, the way the instructors actually went about this. But their whole focus, again, came back to truly sizing up what you had in situational awareness. And, I was really intrigued with this, and I've spent some time over the last, 3 or 4 days really looking at this and thinking about it more. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that as we get, into this. But, the most important thing I want folks to realize is how important size up truly is. And if you go to our NIOSH reports and you look at line of duty deaths and injuries and things like that that we're seeing on a consistent basis, we know that size up is one of the problems or one of the areas that they address as being lacking. How many times have you used that in the class, Chris?
Well, when you talk about size up, Doug, I mean, it goes back to a much bigger picture. And size up truly is one of the most critical elements on the fire ground. And I think what we've seen over the last couple of years in particular with the increased focus on firefighter line of duty deaths, the whole firefighter safety initiatives, we're reexamining much of what our methodologies are and how they really are going to be demanded upon themselves to change. You go back to strategy and tactics when we talk about that in the big scheme of things. Size up itself actually was developed back in the 1940s. And if you go back a little bit historically, Chief Lloyd Lehman, who many of our listeners should be aware of, developed much of our methodologies dealing with fog stream operations and his landmark presentation at FDIC in 1950, in which he did a program called the Little Drops of Water. And that really introduced the whole aspect of fog stream type operations and looking at solid streams versus the applications that we are currently utilizing in terms of our operations. But Chief Lehman in 1941 actually started developing and writing some of the initial issues dealing with size up. He actually coined the phrase of size up and had five predominant size up factors, and that dealt with incident scene facts, probabilities, your own situation dealing with what you were confronted with at that particular time, the decision-making process, and then ultimately your plan of operation. When you really look at that, in all of the years that have gone past, over the last 70 to 75 years, our strategies and tactics, coupled with our size up philosophy, have really not changed dramatically. We've added some different things, we've coined some different phases, but in the big scheme of things, we are standing at a time in which size up is no longer, the traditional form of size up is no longer appropriate. It's really antiquated in terms of what we're facing in current day company officer operations, again, in the street, with the types of structures as it relates to all of the history repeating events that we're seeing through our NIOSH reports and all of these case studies.
You know, simply put, size up and incident planning saves lives. It makes incidents more manageable. We know that when we do a size up, and I mean truly get down and dirty with this concept of understanding what's going on, firefighters get an accurate picture of the conditions at that incident, no matter what the incident is. And we know, without a doubt, without exception, that our firefighting forces are probably the most vulnerable during interior structure firefighting. You know, this operational environment has drastically changed. Looking at the modern environment, we know we have more BTUs being produced by the types of materials that are in there. We know our fuel loading is at least double to triple what it was, you know, 20, 25 years ago. And when we look at this environment, think about comparing this to a battlefield. It most closely resembles the combat setting, you know, in which we engage in war. Well, if you think about it, you know, the way that I see how this applies is that our fire grounds, our incidents, the situations that we're getting into is our battlefield. And before we start committing forces, it requires us to look at four imperative strategic considerations. One, is committing our troops absolutely necessary? You know, is there a compelling risk posed by not acting? You know, sometimes it's better not to do anything or be aggressive than to, you know, really get aggressive. And I use the term, and I've used this several times in podcasts and in classes and in writings, is aggressive versus reckless. And, of course, we always have to look, if we're going to do this, we have to look at overwhelming resources that's got to be applied, what you've got to have to get the job done, and people fit into that. And, of course, we must have a clear exit strategy in place. So looking at the importance of size up, this is when we really get into diving into, you know, accurately looking at the true situation or the conditions. And that's back to that situational awareness. We know on structure fires that, you know, the statistics are telling us that, you know, for many of these scenarios that we get into, one-third of the most common cause of firefighter injuries in structure fires, and looking back over from 2004, you know, through the current time period, almost a third of these are due to structural collapses. And I feel this personally with, you know, the loss of a friend in the fire service last year and a, you know, very close personal friend in Robin Brockstrom, and a captain up in Ohio. So what's your thought here, Chris?
Absolutely, Doug. You know, you make mention of the issue dealing with the military approach and the battle plans that we normally draw out. And I use a similar analogy. I mean, when you talk about combat structural fire suppression, I mean, that's what we are actually looking at it from the standpoint of these structures, the unique characteristics, because, again, the buildings themselves have changed dramatically, the size, the volumes, the fire loading themselves. And then coupled with that, the fire service itself has changed dramatically in terms of our experience levels and our capabilities to understand and truly size up these structures. You add to that risk assessment and situational awareness that are becoming more commonplace in terms of our terminology, but they mean pretty much the same things. We need to assess these structures. We need to assess the conditions, The fire dynamics is another element dealing with the whole issue of fire behavior. And then the situational awareness factors that all come into play that, again, when you look at it, it involves of being aware of what's happening around us, understanding that information and the events, understanding our actions, our companies, our personnel, and how they're interfacing with that operation, what the operational goals might be and our objectives, and then how that incident is evolving. You know, none of this is static. And we have a tendency when we, especially years ago, and you've been around long enough to understand this, when we were company officers, you know, certainly back in the 80s and even into the early 90s, size up had a different perspective. The manner in which our aggressiveness dealt with the structures, you know, we went into almost an automatic mode of operation regardless of the building. We took a look at some factors and so forth, but we truly didn't understand the risk assessments and the dynamics around that. Now we add into this whole factor situational awareness, and we start playing the role both dealing with the incident commander, the company officer, and the firefighters. It's really an orchestrated element for everyone to understand what's going on inside of the building, what's going on throughout the outside of the building on a whole 360 on all points, and monitoring those conditions on a continuous type basis. And in developing appropriate battle action plans, it's more than just an incident action plan, but battle action plans to appropriately address those issues while maintaining the balance of risk.
And looking at that, one of the factors that I look at is, you know, what truly are we talking about here with size up? I know we've thrown out a lot of these things, but I'm going to break it down, I believe, for people on the streets that are listening. Is I equate this to making a recipe, you know, your favorite dish. There's certain ingredients that must go in. In size up, I think there's five ingredients. The first one is pre-incident. You know, going out and sizing up something before anything ever occurs is just so, so important. That's when we dive into the meat and potatoes of what's in the building, what's our fire loading. You know, we can play all these what-if scenarios. We can walk through them. We've got time. We're not under the gun. We also take a look at probably the biggest piece in this that has changed, I guess probably the most over the last 15 years, is building construction. We have a point in time then that we can truly analyze this building, especially if we start pre-incident survey in the construction phase. And I think that's important that we're out really looking at our territories and knowing what's being built and how. The second one is predicting. When performing a size up, we have to be able to predict what the present situation is going to lead to. I know that the concepts of how I teach rapid intervention and those things is I always tell the people that are in the class when we're doing lectures and we're talking about predicting and size up and those things is you can't be preparing for what's going on now because you're behind the eight ball. You have to plan 10 to 15 minutes ahead of time of what could potentially happen and have a game plan in place. And that kind of goes back to the actions. You know, we want to have these facts and these clues that we take and throw together, and all of a sudden we want to throw out, you know, our actions. Our actions need to be very, very, I think, well thought out. And, you know, the fact of commissioning firefighting forces, you know, into interior operation has become just, like you said, automatic. It's reflective of our tactical actions. I mean, we've done it for years. It's just bang, 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 we do it. And all of a sudden, there's no credible.
Those actions actually have to start before you even step out of the front seat of the cab. You know, before you even step foot in the road. You know, you go back to understanding the building. If you don't understand and know what's in your first due area, what's in your jurisdiction and your mutual aid response or greater alarm response areas, you have to have a profound understanding of the buildings and at least an understanding of the structural elements that keep the building stable in their day-to-day existence. And then adding, you know, a fire situation and scenario to that when we pull up in the street, you know, you need to start being able to predict how that building will perform, because before you actually deploy, because that's really going to determine whether you've got a go or no-go situation and moving into an offensive or marginal or defensive strategy.
Well, you hit on something. Les Stevens and I talked about that, you know, several months ago of go, no-go situations. And, you know, firefighters are entering these atmospheres, just like you're saying. We're entering these buildings, these conditions, whether it's fire, whether it's, you know, another situation. And, you know, we're not taking in the number four component here, your priorities. And, you know, the number one priority is life safety. And, of course, we got to think of ourselves. But, you know, how many times do we have true, impeccable evidence that there is a need for a search and a rescue that is probable? And again, even if somebody's in there, what are the chances of survival? You know, how we're building buildings and the types of materials we're putting in there has drastically changed that environment and the products that are, you know, being produced off of, you know, fire propagation. And of course, throughout this whole thing, number five is we got to do this continual. There must be a compelling effort to look at the risk posed nonstop through this whole piece of what we're talking about here. And I think at that point in time, we're truly going to be moving towards what I would call situational awareness. And you threw out, you know, Chief Layman. You know, I can remember in his later years, you know, seeing things and reading things, especially when I first got into the fire service in the late 70s, with, you know, the facts, the probabilities, the own situation, going in to make a decision and developing that plan of action. And I think a lot of times our plan of action is to commit before we really understand what we're up against, and I think we're seeing the results of that. What do you think?
Absolutely. You know, and you hit upon another key item here. When we talk about strategy and tactics, our strategy and tactics that we currently utilize were born out of consistency and an understanding of how buildings performed in a different time and place. You could assume and predict a particular type of room and contents fire or structure fire to react in a predictable fashion, alarm after alarm, in certain building types. And that was pretty true all the way up through about the mid-70s. From the mid-70s all the way to our current time frame, because of the changes in construction, materials, engineered systems, the fire loading, all of the other variables that have gone into our construction and occupancies of current date, those types of consistencies are no longer present. And now we have far more variables that have to be assessed on a continuous basis throughout the operation, both, you know, responding to the alarm and certainly all the way through mitigation and take-up. But you made a point about the risk assessment. Risk assessment is dynamic. It has to be a continuing process unto itself. And again, and it's also problematic because you have conflicting priorities and there's conflicting demands and distractions. And again, when you take a look at mission critical issues for the company officer or the incident commander, you know, risk has to be assessed in a dynamic fashion and constantly weighed out against the situational conditions that the companies and the incident commanders are confronted with. You add situational awareness to it from all levels, and you start evaluating, you know, again, going to a residential fire. Does our company officer, do our personnel know that we have engineered floor systems in that building? Do we understand changes in terms of occupancy type and how that may have affected the fire suppression system? Have there been alterations to the building? Even just responding from a residential to a commercial-type setting, understanding that there are vast differences in strategy and tactics, hose line deployment, the amount of adequacy of water, and again, the very simple element here that we're talking about, firefighter safety, whether it's a go or no-go. Do I maintain a defensive posture, or do I utilize offensive in a situation that has a good level of safety margin that I can afford my firefighters? We sometimes have this conflicting issue with who we are and what we're doing. But again, the demands are out there, and you take a look at the case studies, you know, they're far and vast issues here. We can go back to the issues with Charleston, certainly, when we talk about a variety of factors. And I only bring that up because the NIOSH report just came out here this afternoon, dealing with the Charleston incident and so forth. And you talk about size up and risk factors, and those are very prominent on the high list of recommendations that NIOSH is talking about in terms of the same things that we're talking about, understanding the building, the fire loading, having appropriate tactics and strategies, maintaining a constant situational awareness of all of the dynamics and factors. And, you know, Doug, the biggest thing, too, is having everyone in the system, from the firefighter to the company officer, to the incident commander, and everyone in between that's providing the geographical support on that incident scene, understanding what they're looking at, reading the situation, reading the smoke, understanding building performance, and appropriately deploying the right tactics to our battle action plans to come up with a successful conclusion.
Well, I'm going to be the back row Baptist here and give you an amen and, you know, jump up and down and yell hallelujah. You're exactly right. And, you know, I think back to some classes I've sat in and listening to the people, you know, talk like Vincent Dunn, you know, in one of his programs, talking about the elements of size up, the same things we're going through here. You know, yeah, we want to know the fire size and location. That's important. Because I think we're so programmed today that, you know, when we pull up and it's a size up and we see fire, we see smoke, the first, you know, element that we go into is this automated approach that, you know, we're going to pull this inch and three-quarter line because that's what we do every day. You know, we're going to go up here and we think about ventilation. We're going to put a positive pressure fan at the door and open a window. I think we're beginning to become too automated in our thought process, as you're describing. But we need to look at some elements. And, of course, we talk about the size of the buildings, the condition on arrival, the age of the building. You threw out a couple of pieces that are very, very critical, and I want to add to those. The occupancy change was a big one, you know, some renovations in the buildings and modification. One of the pieces that comes to my mind is, you know, Boston and the Vendome, where renovations were going on, but supported loads, there had been some changes, and, you know, a support had been pulled out, and that precipitated that collapse. And again, has there been previous fires in this building? You know, that's a big piece. We got to think about some of these things that we don't necessarily address in our minds pulling up. You know, what has changed? The other thing that sticks out, and I heard this, you know, this weekend with the Powell Doctrine that these guys were, you know, from the North Carolina Office of State Fire Marshal were talking about, and looking at this, is that we need to have adequate or overwhelming resources that need to be applied. The first thing, you know, that pops up in your mind is, oh, you know, NFPA 1710, 1720. Well, you know, we talk about personnel, and one of the components that I had to voice my opinion on, and I'll voice it here again, is, yeah, you can send me overwhelming personnel resources, but are they adequately trained? And what we're seeing is, you know, there is a national standard. It's NFPA 1001 for firefighters. But all, you know, too often, you know, states and jurisdictions and everybody has, you know, the AHJ, the authority having jurisdiction, can decide exactly what that training is going to be. And what I see is that we're getting resources that, you know, we may get 20 people to show up, but do those 20 people really know what they need to know about firefighting on a basic, back to the basics level? You know, NFPA 1001, or have they just been kind of piecemealed together and blessed on a battlefield promotion because we need bodies out there to make a roster or to run the calls? You know, I got some real heartburn with that, and I know you probably do too.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, again, you know, when we talk at this level, you know, we're talking about truisms that are born out of experience in the street and understanding where those failure point mechanisms are and where the focus needs to be. Truly, if you can have, as you mentioned so eloquently, you can have a high degree of resources and companies and equipment and apparatus and all these personnel, but unless they understand what they're seeing, understanding what their particular task is from a tactical level, appropriate supervision of the company officer who, again, is knowledgeable and is utilizing his good situational awareness to communicate what's occurring on the battleground, occurring what's inside of the building, and is able to, again, accurately communicate back out to command what he's seeing, what's going on, what they're picking up during the course of their operations. Only then can we have the appropriateness of strategies and incident action plans correlate with appropriate strategy and tactics. But if I have one missing link, if I have personnel operating in various divisions and groups and so forth, if I have weaknesses in that link based upon training, based upon inadequacies, I can have, you know, a 10-alarm assignment in there, but it ain't going to be any different than operating with a 2-alarm company or a 1-alarm company. Again, if there's a difference in training and experience levels and not having the effective communications going on in the appropriate fashion. You know, it's a constant cycle, it's a constant demand, and it's actually, when you look at it, it's a combination of the attitudes, our previous learned knowledge and technical capabilities, and our experience. and our experience is truly becoming more difficult to obtain when we talk about some of the types of fire ground conditions that many of our individuals are experiencing throughout the country. We have areas in which we have high demand and high frequency of alarms and true combat fire ground experiences, and then we have other organizations that, you know, have far greater gaps of time. And then when we are confronted with a situation with a working fire and a structural capacity, they may not be putting all of the pieces together in that formula, and they may not be understanding what they're seeing, how they're operating, and how that affects the appropriate strategy and tactics.
You know, I agree. And here's the other side of that fence I'm going to jump on and talk just very briefly about, is that, you know, we've got a long history of not, you know, being funded to the level that we need to be as a fire service. And you couple that with fire ground commanders who are illogically stingy when it comes to calling for additional resources at any instant. And you take some serious fires, you know, that, you know, we look at, and they're starved for resources. And that's every component of that fire. You know, they don't have what they need to do it. But, you know, again, they say, oh, this is my district, and you can't come over here and play. And, you know, it's a mentality. And for the life of me, I can't understand that mentality. You know, I've had people try to explain it to me, and it still doesn't make sense to me. But, you know, most fire departments consider themselves very fortunate if they have a single four-person company ready to serve when the emergency occurs. You know, very few departments can seriously, I guess, assert themselves, you know, to ensure an adequate number of firefighters on the scene, not calling for, you know, resources early in a timely manner. You know, is just doesn't make any sense whatsoever to me. And I think that there's, you know, the point that we come back and say that we've always been too little, too late, and that's kind of the theories or the voices that I'm hearing from every one of the NAS reports that address inadequate resources.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and a lot of organizations, or the ineffectiveness of command, just putting more and more resources into the equation to try to overwhelm the situation versus understanding the issues, understanding the calculations of what's needed based upon that building, and changing the strategic perspectives to put the best level of resources that you do have either in the appropriate locations or to change your overall strategy for that operation. You know, you go back to the Worcester, Mass. Cold storage fire, you know, if Chief McMee did not physically stop the additional resources that were coming toward that building, stopping, again, going from a situation in which we have a loss of situational awareness, you know, that the fire ground changed dramatically, we have lost and unaccounted for firefighters, which an unknown number at that time, and again, the most natural course of action in many organizations would be to do what? Put more resources in, try to locate the Down brothers and so forth, but you've got to look at it from the standpoint of, again, risk assessment, the situational conditions, and the effectiveness of the resources. And sometimes you just have to say, you know, the losses are far greater at this point. We have to stop and change and go to a different direction. Now, that particular situation was obviously very extreme with the loss of our brother firefighters in the circumstances, but every day we look at residential occupancies and commercial and the hybrid structures and so forth, and are we truly equating the right level of risk, the right ingredient of strategy and tactics, understanding the building's structural profile and how it's going to perform, and then having, as you mentioned, the appropriate balance of resources to do the job within the time frame that's allotted to us. And sometimes that unknown factor of time is truly unknown. You know, there's some things that are starting to come out as a result of some of the new Underwriter Laboratory test studies that just recently were completed. Tyco Fire Suppression and Building Products also put out some good new information dealing with the performance of engineered floor systems in particular, or engineered wood product systems. And I think the fire service, for those that have not yet gone to some of the website and seen some of the preliminary information, our strategy and tactics, just in terms of time in these structures, is going to change dramatically. It's no longer going to be that 15 to 20 minute rule time frame or that unknown, because we're certainly not sometimes predicting appropriately how that building is going to perform. We're looking at very smaller margins of operational time, which sometimes they're going to just say to us, you know, unless there's a true defined need for a life safety issue where we have a viable rescue, you need to be able to start writing off and going into a defensive mode of operations. Unless you're looking at it from the standpoint where, you know, you just aren't balancing out the lives of your firefighters appropriately.
Well, that actually starts to lead us into the next topic that I have in Size Up, but we're about the halfway mark and we need to take a break. You're listening to Training and Tactics Talk on RadioFirehouse.com. And again, if you would like to get questions to us or you have thoughts or areas that you would like to see addressed on Training and Tactics Talk, please email it to us at RadioFirehouse.com, and we'll be glad to address that for you. Again, let's take a short break. We'll be back with Training and Tactics Talk right after this.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm Douglas Klein, your host, and with us today is Christopher Nam. And we're talking about size up and situational awareness and how that truly affects fire ground operations and how we address, you know, our tactical components, you know, when we're arriving, while we're on the scene, as we continue to go through there. The second half of the show here, I really want to take a look at arriving on the scene and talking about size up when you arrive. You know, part of what I think we miss a lot of times is the importance of painting the picture when you arrive on scene. You know, communications is vital, and the breakdown of that on the fire ground has always been, you know, one of our more important issues to address, because it comes up again most every NOSH or report that you look at, that there was some type of failure in communications, and we know this. I mean, this is talked about in fire officer books. It's talked about almost in every post-incident analysis that's done. And there's more critical time, you know, looking at this in the beginning of an operation, that with the eyes of the department and the responding group, that first arriving person on scene or that officer has to engage those people with painting a picture. And, of course, you know, when they're arriving on scene, taking a look at all the things we've talked about, they have to decide, are we going into a rescue mode? Are we going to go offensive? Are we going to go defensive? You know, what are our tactics truly going to be? So let's look at this and describing when you arrive on scene. You know, how many times, Chris, have you heard people pull up on the scene and just check on scene and there's nothing else?
Far too many, Doug. Far, far too many. And the actions are pretty detrimental when you get into that mode. So.
So when you pull up, you know, we need to be describing the building. You know, I'm on scene with a two-story wood frame residential structure, or I'm on scene with a large warehouse. You know, you need to describe the fire. Dave Dotson's auto reading smoke, volume, velocity, density, and color. Tell me what that smoke is doing. Paint that picture. Tell me about the fire. You know, tell me if there are lives at risk, if we know. Tell me what your actions are going to be. You know, what have you got planned? What's in the initial incident action plan that you're thinking at this point in time and getting it out? Begin describing the location of maybe where you're going to set the command post, if possible, and guiding resources on things that you may see that they don't see. We know that, you know, we set up, you know, standing operating guidelines to, you know, cover who's getting water supply, what the first truck does, what the rescue may do or the squad may do. I know arriving on scenes, you know, as a company officer, even as an incident commander, what normally would happen couldn't happen because of, you know, some element that's there that's changing that dynamic. So you got to communicate. And I'll never forget, you know, being dispatched one time to a vehicle fire, riding in a multi-piece station. You know, we rolled out with a rescue pumper and a ladder company. That was our protocol. Well, when I arrived on scene, you know, it was a vehicle fire, all right. It was a Traco that was on fire. But it hit a 5-inch high-pressure gas main. Not to mention the Traco being on fire, the 5-inch gas main that was burning. You know, I had another dump truck that was on fire, a pickup truck that was on fire, a generator that was on fire with lights, a power pole, and a sign at a gas station. And I had fire, you know, probably standing 70, 80 feet in the air, and a huge roar. that was a whole lot different than the initial dispatch. So, you know, I began giving a spiel. And I can remember my driver, you know, I didn't get out of the apparatus all the way. I was still on the radio talking and had the door open. And I was on the ladder company, and he was wanting to back up and get his own hydrant because when we came around the corner, we found this. And, you know, obviously, you know, he had a few choice words for the captain that was hanging out the window talking on the radio about, you know, shutting up or get on the portable so I can do my job. But, you know, that was important. You know, I was calling an alarm assignment. I was calling special resources. I wanted them to come in from different directions. I wanted their own water supply. I knew this was going to be a defensive operation of just protecting exposure. So in that initial report, how important have you found it, Chris, that if we don't have this information, what happens to the incident?
That first due communication is mission critical. Whether it's coming from the first due company officer, whether it's coming from the second due apparatus based upon, you know, the transfer of command, or the arriving commanding officer, that first level of communication sets into motion a variety of conditions. It sets into motion what you're going to be expecting to do based upon your SOPs and protocols. It also sets into motion the mindset based upon what you're expecting to be confronted with, the severity and the magnitude. You know, there's a variety of conditions, and if that's lacking, then we go into this auto mode, as we talked about during the first half of our program, where our tactics and strategies are all driven by our procedures and operational guides. We go into a reactionary mode. Instead of interfacing with the incident and understanding what we're seeing and the dynamics of that situation, we go into this auto mode, which typically are what we end up reading about in line-of-duty deaths or significant large loss fire situations. If I have an effective communication that's giving me crucial data relative to the building in terms of its occupancy type, possibly the level of severity and the degree of fire involvement as you described, utilizing the appropriate parameters of reading the smoke conditions if they are present, the magnitude, the severity, the density, the velocity. I mean, these are mission critical factors that when I look back upon, you know, my years of working in the street as a company officer and as a commanding officer, those are crucial in determining the actions of the next arriving companies and how they're going to operate and how we are going to take all that information and put it together into an effective and safe incident action plan. If I don't have that information relative to what my direction needs to be, then I start losing that focus and I lose my situational awareness. And it goes back into the essence of what we're talking about. The size up, the situational awareness, the risk factors, these are dynamic situations that are going to be constantly evolving as we continue in, but they all start with keying that first mic when we arrive on scene and communicating that mission-critical information to the arriving and or responding companies and personnel.
Well, and I couldn't agree with you more, and you said it very well there. The other part of this is if we don't do it, what's going to happen? You know, let's look realistically at some of the facets that exist in the fire service. Is that this little, you know, start out part of our incident, the beginning phases, the size up, the direction, if it's not done and we don't take a strong, true, committed, you know, command, a very stiff command role and begin, I guess, delegating and directing, the nice little things called freelancing begin to occur. And we all know that freelancing is a bad thing. We know that it loses our command and control. We know that we don't always get accomplished what we want. People begin to take, you know, unnecessary risks. It has catastrophic effects on the actual incident action plan, the incident itself, that can create some pretty bad situations that we're in. And, you know, unless we get this, you know, down pat, this beginning, you know, the whole page here, we're going to have issues. And as I travel across the United States and I have the opportunity to listen to people's radio traffic or they talk about the incidents, and of course most people want to play the tape for you, or if they got videos and you can hear radio traffic, or even looking at the reports, you know, of the benchmark radio traffic as it goes through, we find right from the get-go that the components that we read out here about describing the building, the fire, the assessment of lives and risks, you know, what actions are planned and underway, who's going to be in charge of this, you know, what are the other duties for companies coming in, and do we need, you know, additional resources? And that goes back to pre-incident surveys as well. And having that game plan, I talked about that earlier, and I remember, you know, as I was working in Chapel Hill, especially as a company officer, I had, you know, districts that I worked in various capacities, whether on an engine, a truck, or a squad, whatever. And, you know, we started planning out what we would do if this building was on fire. And lo and behold, it paid off one day. We rolled out of the station. We were just, you know, two blocks away from this apartment complex. It's on fire. You can see the fire pulling out of the station. Fortunately, we had adequate resources. We were right at shift change, so we were loaded heavy on the engine. And, you know, pulling in, I had rehearsed what I would say, what I was going to do, what if we found this situation, what if we found that situation. I knew exactly, you know, what needed to be done because it was already, you know, thought out. It was, you know, very well strategized on theories, on paper, on, you know, practice tactics. So when we rolled up on the scene, we had a rescue. We knew that. You know, it was very early on. We had heavy fire conditions. And automatically, it was give me a second alarm. You know, it was never a question. Give me a second alarm. We're going to rescue mode. And, of course, you know, now, you know, I'm engaged as an operating command officer on the scene because there's so many tasks that have to get accomplished with a known rescue, you know, that there really wasn't the ability to transfer the command in the manner that we'd like to transfer it. So I know, Chris, that you've traveled a lot and you've been engaged in fire departments and training across the United States just like I have and had the opportunity to see this. How many times do you truly see departments and officers have this level of thought process together?
I think what you're seeing, Doug, you know, and again, you make a great point there. There are significant gaps around the country. And again, there are some very small organized departments in suburban or rural settings that do an exceptional job. But the ad only comes about as a result of rigorous, fundamental training, practicing these elements that we're talking about. And again, these guys could go toe-to-toe with the most busiest company in a large metropolitan area. But at the same time, I've also seen large metropolitan organizations that are very deficient in carrying forward much of what we're talking about. Because, again, they go into an auto mode of operation. Same type of building, same set of circumstances. And, again, the circumstances at each given subsequent alarm are pretty much the same as the last. It's the unusual conditions that might be confronting them at that particular incident on that particular day that translate into a more significant, again, injury or ultimately into a line of duty death. But all in all, I think when you look at our change in generations, you know, the fire service is really evolving now. Many of our personnel, especially back from the 70s and 80s, have reached those retirement marks, and we're seeing a different level of fire ground commander, a different level and characteristics of our company officers, and even our firefighters. We've got to get back to this fundamental, as we've been talking about, fundamental perspective of understanding those various components on size up, what they mean, and more importantly, expanding that out to the variables of what can change based upon our unique characteristics of buildings and occupancies and construction and so forth, so that they're able to assess and calculate out what they need to do. You know, the other part of that, too, that I think we missed the opportunity to talk about is that 360. You know, years ago when we first talked about size up, you know, we were always talking about looking at least 2 to 3 sides of the building and going past the structure and so forth. But even with a change of buildings and styles and occupancies, you know, that luxury no longer exists. You've really got to physically get out there and take the time to do a 360 around that building while communicating your size up or changing your size up based upon what changes you've seen on the Charlie side or Delta side as you've done those things. And, again, time and time again, we have NIOSH reports, we have U.S. Fire Administration reports, case studies that are being promoted out there telling us that the failure of doing these fundamental size-up factors, effectively communicating and understanding what you're seeing and then having the appropriate strategy and tactics, those elements not coming together ultimately causing something of a detrimental standpoint in that incident. And we have to really get back to that fundamental level of training and really start promoting that. You know, you look at the last number of years, we train in a variety of different areas. And, you know, I'll go out on a limb because when I go out teaching around the country, I pretty much say, although RIT team and fast team operations has its place on the fire ground, RIT is not it. RIT does not give us the kinds of things that we are lacking on the fire ground in terms of the focused training that is needed, both from a company officer, incident commander, and firefighter standpoint. We've got to get back into some fundamental company-level training that much of what you are promoting and professing with strategy and tactics and our whole focus on SISEP is really all about.
Well, you jump over into one of the last components that I really want to hit on here, and you hit on the training very well, and I'm going to stand there and say that, you know, in our prioritization of what we're going to do on emergency scene, setting our priorities, number one we know is life safety, number two is incident control, number three is property conservation, in those orders. That life safety component sticks out the most. I think about the need to train people to be able to do rescues. That's important. I also think that we need to train people to recognize that we're a valuable resource. We got to go to the next level of training. We truly have to get to the effective level of training and get away from this cognitive level that, you know, is just the beginning phases. You know, in the domains of learning, we know that there's cognitive, there's psychomotor, and there's effective. Effective learning means that these people can truly take situations, as we're talking about here, and happenings around them and begin to work through them and understand what needs to be done. That's the true level of learning that we've got to get people to. That's the true level of training we got to focus on. Because in our deployment models, we think about, you know, getting hose lines in, trying to get the control of the incident, preserving property. We know that life safety is truly important. But I think we start without a clear exit strategy in mind or in place. And our accepted deployment model is an aggressive interior attack, often conducted, and most often conducted without the possibility of successful rescues. And it's almost always for the sole objective of fire extinguishment. Now think about it. How many times do we go in and think rescue, 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 and we don't even know if there's anybody in the building. But our whole goal is we got to get in there. And the premise behind that, the hidden component, is we've got to put the fire out. And far too often, our entry strategy, which is, I guess, our de facto exit strategy, fails. You know, and it fails because we don't include rapid and coordinated ventilation. We don't include laddering for life. We don't include the effective command and control and the presence of ready reserves that are instantaneously deployable. We miss that. And inevitable, you know, our result factors are going to be deterioration conditions that can set, you know, into motion a series of events that are going to cause firefighters to be in positions that, you know, we're overexposing them. We're getting them into places, and because we've got this great gear is the reason we're surviving. And part of my opinion is not that we're doing great tactics sometimes. There's no safety margin in existence. And as a result of that, when something is wrong, we've got a very chaotic, a very risky, and oftentimes an unsuccessful, unthought-out, clear exit strategy of how we're going to stop this event. You know, think about the first Gulf War. You know, we were in and out in 30 days. They went in. They knew what they wanted to do. They went to a certain level. They weren't going past that. Once they accomplished what they wanted, they backed out. You know, for us, we go in, and how many times do we hear people, and this goes back to training, is you need to back out of the structure, you know, given reasons, given an evacuation sign. Chief, give us another minute. We can get it. You know, in reality, all we're doing is giving you another minute to kill yourself. I know you've seen it, Chris. What do you think?
Absolutely, Doug, absolutely. You know, and it goes back to a real fundamental element that many of our listeners may have heard about. You know, you go back to some of the initiatives with the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation and the courage to be safe. You know, understanding and setting the example, understanding the limitations, the courage to do the right thing in order to protect not only yourself but the other firefighters, the fortitude and the limitations, and understanding the consequences of our actions. You know, it's no longer reactionary. Yes, we are firefighters. Yes, we have been sworn to do our duties, but we have to understand those limitations, have balanced risk management, have the appropriate command presence and leadership. And again, it goes back to doing the right thing at the right time for the right reasons, you know, within our roles and responsibilities. You know, and it's a cooperative effort because everybody has to be part of that system. And, you know, unless we have, you know, good levels of competencies within all levels of our personnel to perform the tasks that are assigned, you know, we have an effective team organization within our company-type setting, self-discipline to work within the acceptable levels of our systems and operations, but at the same time to also be adaptable to those changing circumstances, going back to the situations and the dynamics of the fire ground. And then again, the other part of that when we talk about the training component is understanding and being able to recognize our own limitations and abilities, because it's a balanced approach toward all of that. Those are the things that are going to set us apart and truly make us safe when we're operating in the street. You know, we've got to be conservative, but we also have to be aggressive and just understand the appropriate profiles of that risk, understand what's calculated when we take a look at those risks and understand what's appropriate, and then don't overextend ourselves and don't fall under that Superman syndrome that, you know, we can do it all. And ultimately, you know, we've seen those results from that standpoint.
Well, you know, to kind of put a cap on all this, because we're right at the end of the show here, is that, you know, looking back to what we've talked about, bottom line is if we're not doing effective size-ups, if we're not training our people to do effective size-ups, then we're beginning to fall behind. But much more than that is we need to train them to that level or to the effective level to where they can really do size-ups with risk identification, risk analysis, looking at benefits and deficiencies, and gaining what is true situational awareness. I mean, the true understanding of fire propagation, of building construction, of fire dynamics, and exactly what's going to happen, you know, in the future, you know, in the 10 minutes to 15 minute period down the road. Understanding, you know, what the fire loading is going to impact, you know, the structure, how that dynamic's going to relate. And looking at a history of that structure itself. So I think, you know, when we kind of recap this, is that, you know, size up is very critical. The situational awareness component, I think, is just unacceptable if it's not in the place, period. We've got to change and move to a much higher level. I think it's time that the fire service raises the bar on company officers and officers and people that are required to make size-ups to truly get down to where they have situational awareness and have that effective learning. And I think failure to do that is going to result just as Billy G's program several years ago, The Beat Goes On. You know, I was reintroduced to that, you know, just the other afternoon, and hearing it again, it just really drove home the whole meaning behind why we're doing training and tactics talk. Is trying to get this information out. Chris, having you on board this month is a true honor and a pleasure and a privilege. We go back a long period of time, and, you know, actually to say it, my early years in the International Society of Fire Service Instructors, you were a mentor. So it's nice to be working with a mentor hand-in-hand and trying to relay some information.
Well, thank you very much, Doug. I certainly appreciate that. I'll leave one bit of information out there for our audience and some things that really sort of, again, fully cap what you're talking about. Size up itself, as it was at least presented in the past, truly has to equate back to dynamic risk assessment and situational awareness. And that's really going to give us our formulative capabilities going forward. And I'll leave you with this one analogy when we talk about a concept called become safe. And it sort of wraps into all the things that we've just talked about. You take a look at Become Safe. It deals with our building, our evaluation, our construction and our occupancy, our operational hazards, the management of our time, the engagement of our companies, situational awareness, our assessment process and risk, fire behaviors and fire dynamics, and the evaluation process of that. That really sort of covers a lot of what we've talked about and just puts it all under one nice little capstone regarding size up, keeping our troops safe in the streets, and, again, just doing the right thing and the courage to do the right thing. thing at the right time. So thanks again, Doug.
You're quite welcome. Well, as we wrap up this edition of Training and Tactics Talk on RadioFirehouse.com, I do want to say that Training and Tactics Talk, this podcast is dedicated to the training of our firefighters and our officers in the streets. You know, our programs will explore a variety of topics and avenues, and we want to keep focusing on keeping firefighters safe. And our ultimate goal is to ensure that every effort's been made to make sure that everyone goes home. And through quality information, training concepts, and tactical considerations for today's fire service listeners and learners that are out there, Training and Tactics Talk this year is going to focus on, you know, just exactly that. We've got coming up, you know, a deeper look into the Powell Doctrine and how it applies to, you know, deploying incident action plans and utilizing our resources. We're going to talk engine company, operation truck company, operation searching in the modern environment, a variety of components of ventilation. We're going to really dive into this. So, you know, we invite you to come back every month and listen to what we have. We've got some great guests that are lined up, just like our guest today, Christopher Nam. We appreciate him being on board. And until next month, you're listening to the Training and Tactics Talk. I'm Douglas Klein, your host, and we look forward to having you next month when you join in to learn more about today's fire service.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.